What's it look like to do something that the previous two generations haven't been able to do?
Hi, I'm Carl Vaders, and welcome to The Church Lobby, Conversations on Faith and Ministry. My guest in this episode is Todd Wilson, and we'll be talking about some of the lessons we're now learning as we look back at 70 years of the church growth movement. Our conversation is based on the content of Todd's new book, How Did We Get Here? Looking Back to Look Forward, which is a thorough examination of 70 years of the church growth movement. A PDF of his book is available in the show notes for free. If this topic sounds familiar, it should, because this was the subject of my book, Desizing the Church, How Church Growth Became a Science, Then an Obsession, and What's Next. One big difference, however, is that Todd, as the co-founder and founding CEO of Exponential, didn't just come up in the church growth movement, he was a leader within it. So he has a unique perspective to offer about some of the unintended negative consequences. And don't forget to stick around when the interview is done. I'll come back with my short take on that phrase that Todd and I will repeat several times in this conversation, the idea of unintended negative consequences and how we can help reduce them in the future. Also, just for your awareness, we had a small technical glitch when my mic cuts out and goes to my supplemental mic. The audio stays very clear, but it will sound different. I just want you to know that's on our system, not on yours. Well, Todd Wilson, welcome to the Church Lobby. It's good to have you here.
Great to be here, Carl. I've been looking forward to talking with you.
Yeah, me too. One of the wonderful things that I've enjoyed about hosting a podcast and being an author as part of that is I now get a whole bunch of advanced copies of books, some of which I have no interest in, some of which I'm vitally interested in. And yours is one of those really high on the list. It was like, oh, I get to take a look at this thing a little bit early. So I got an early copy of your book, How Did We Get Here? Looking Back to Look Forward. But actually, before we get to that, it's kind of got two subtitles. Because the official subtitle is Looking Back to Look Forward, but on the cover I've got, which is an advanced copy, and maybe it changes by the time the book comes out, is Examining 70 Years of the Church Growth Movement. So first of all, which subtitle is it?
It's actually both, not to confuse you. So when you actually get the hard copy, you're going to see one of those subtitles on the front of the book and one of those subtitles on the side spine.
That's what I noticed.
And it just in a nutshell, the original whole idea was we got to look back to look forward. And if we want to move into the future, we got to look back. So the original subtitle was the How Did We Get Here? Looking Back to Look Forward. Once we got to the putting the book together and the cover design people, and I had a couple of the people working on cover design say, you know, people might look at this and not even know it's a church thing. Like if you don't put something in that highlights what, and that's where the Examining 70 Years of the Church movement came from. I will say quickly before we move on, as I've had the advanced copy sitting with me at restaurants and stuff at this point, it's actually been amazing. The title, How Did We Get Here, being prominent on the cover. Every pastor in America needs to have like a copy of it just for the evangelistic part. People stop and say, that's a great question. How did we get here? Mm-hmm. But they're talking about a whole different context than the history of the church growth movement. So that's why we need that tagline so people know that's what it's about.
Yeah, everybody's got a different gear in their mind. So, but yours is specifically about the church growth movement, which of course, as my listeners know, is very much what my book, Desizing the Church, was all about. And I came at it because we spend our time mostly with small church pastors. We're often, you know, we use the phrase for years, we feel like we're pulling bodies out of the river, people who are victims of some of the unintended consequences of the church growth movement. And so I decided I'm going to go upriver and find out who's been tossing the bodies in. Basically, mine was starting with that question. How did we get here to this point where we've demoralized so many faithful pastors because they haven't reached a size that we think they ought to reach, or they're not increasing everything single year like we ought to reach. So I came into this exploration of the unintended consequences of the church growth movement because it didn't work for me, but it worked for you. So I'm coming at it from someone for whom it didn't work. You're coming at it as one of the names connected to successful church movements and successful multiplication and so on, which is what part of what fascinates me about this conversation, because we meet together in the middle with great deal of overlap agreement. but we're coming at it from different failure and success sides of it. And I'm using those both were those words in quotes, of course.
Right.
So talk to me a little bit about how you came to this point where you even wrote this book, given the fact that, hey, this has been working for you by a whole bunch of external measures.
Right. Let me highlight one thing from what you just said. After the book was just about finished, I was having a conversation with Brian Mosley, who leads Right Now Media, and we were talking about the book. And Brian made a comment to me. He said, "Todd, one of the top issues people are talking about right now in my circles are how did we get here?" And that question, how did we get here, to play to what you're saying right now, on one end of the spectrum, people are asking the question, how do we get here, cynically. Because of what's going on in culture, because of what's going on in the church, like how in the world did we get here?
Yeah.
On the other end of the spectrum, what I've discovered through this process, and I mean, you and I have been at this a long time, coming at it from different places. What I discovered is the younger generation right now really doesn't understand the background of how we got here.
No.
They've inherited things, but don't understand. I had a couple of leaders previewing the book, and when they got to the part on Rick Warren's baseball diamond. Oh, I had heard of the baseball diamond. I never really knew what it was.
Oh,
And you
interesting.
got to think that's right at the core of the current operating system in the church. And yet a lot of the young people entering ministry right now don't have even the context of what some of those basic things are that are the building blocks to get us where we are. So when I back the clock up, Carl, though, and like the background on the book, I've spent 25 years now, really championing church planting. Like, my life mission is to see churches embracing church planting and multiplication in whatever form that is, small, big, it doesn't have to be big. There has been a paradigm that you got to be big to do it. And someday when you grow up to be big, you can do it, which is, as you know, a false
Yeah.
narrative. In fact, that's part of our barrier in church. So I have over the past decade had a growing angst that the mission that we had at Exponential to see 16% of churches reproducing, there's no way we're going to get there with the current operating system of church, the way we have done the operating system. So I started on a journey years ago, over 5 years ago, of looking at the actual operating system of church. Like, not how do we get here, but what's the operating system? And what I discovered is, pastors think in terms of models or apps. If you do the phone analogy, there's the operating system inside, but then you have apps and programs that run on the operating system. Pastors don't think about operating systems. They think about what's the app? How do we do the program? How do we have the silver bullet to, the do. And as I studied the operating system, realized that, oh my goodness, we need to have a healthy conversation of unpacking what the actual under the surface operating system that powers most of the churches in America. Again, small, large, it doesn't matter.
Yep.
That's what's fascinating is whether you're a church of 80 or a church of 8,000, I'm going to suggest to you that the average church in America is running on the same operating system. The issue is the model or app of how you do it. So I started a book 5 years ago, identified 12 dimensions of the operating system and how it's good and bad. And started writing that book. And 2 years ago, I was halfway finished. I had 12 dimensions of this operating system, and the book felt really heavy. And so I thought, I got to add a chapter on the modern church growth movement and how we got here. That one chapter hijacked the first book. So I never finished the first book. And in the process of writing that one chapter on the history of the church growth movement, I personally discovered how much I didn't know about how we got here. And so 2 years later, 450 pages, hundreds of hours of interviews. I mean, it's been a massive looking back at the history of how we got here. That's how this book landed. And as a futurist, spending 2 years on a history book, I'm ready to get where this book tries to go, which is to look forward, to get back to the future.
Yeah, you and me both. Your journey sounds so familiar because I'd written four books on a challenge to the operating system, particularly how it affects pastors of small churches. And then it was the same thing. It was like, let me take a little bit of a look in here. And I really thought it might be a podcast episode or something, just like you thought it might be a chapter of your book. And the same thing, it just grew into this monster that I then finally had to whittle down to a book that somebody would actually want to read. because it could have been 2 to 3 times as long as my book was, and yours was the same things. There's so much about how we got here. So you refer to it as a particular operating system, and I love that analogy. We're paying attention to the apps, and we're comparing apps, and hey, look at this cool app that my church is running. And not nearly enough of us are paying attention to what's the underlying operating system that really is the main impact, or maybe we could describe it as culture. What's the culture underlying everything that is really the issue at hand here? So, how do you describe then what is our current operating system?
I've named it affectionately the consumer-driven operating system. I'm not wanting to be a deconstructionist or be negative. I love the local church. My calling is the local church. But I think when we look realistically at what we've got right now, the operating system is programmatic, it's consumer-driven at its core, and it's strongly influenced by business management principles, going back with Peter Drucker and others with the question, who's the customer? What do they value? How do you deliver that value? That's where Saddleback Sam and Sally came from, was who's the customer and how are we going to give them what they need? And so I think we have built on a foundation at this point that is very much the customer orientation. And how you add makes all the difference. If the way you add is programmatically by serving the customer, we squeeze out the disciple-making side of it as the growth engine. And I think what happens is we're left with this operating system that is optimized on conversion and getting numbers, but not necessarily growing and adding in a way that is capable of reproducing and multiplying.
I fully agree. You mentioned Peter Drucker. Let's get to who he was and what he was about, because you very early in the book identify Donald McGavran, as I do in Desizing the Church, as someone that I quite frankly thought would be the villain in the story, and it turns out he wasn't. It
Right.
turns out his ideas were co-opted by a different operating system, and we used his language to a large degree and not really didn't adapt his concepts to the degree that we thought we were. But Peter Drucker is probably a stronger influence upon the consumer-driven operating system, certainly stronger than McGavran. So, who was Peter Drucker and why has he had such a strong influence?
Yeah, I think there's a couple of names, Peter Drucker, Robert Schuller, Bob Buford and Leadership Network. There's a number of groups that, in a positive way, really fueled and poured gas on this, the development of this consumer-driven system. When I started out on this book, Carl, I thought I knew a lot more about this whole integrated history. Like you, I thought, okay, Donald McGavran's the founder of the church growth movement, and he's who I'm going to go look at in this. And how did it get to where it is? And it was actually one of your podcast interviews with Gary McIntosh, where you guys were talking
Yeah.
about this, that put me onto this. And Gary's been such an asset in the conversation that when I learned from your podcast that, Gary said Donald McGavran had planted 15 churches with a collective attendance of less than 1,000 people, that he never planted and grew a church to greater than 1,000, it really threw me off. I had to go back and look, well, wait a minute, what's going on here? And then you discover in the early days with McGavran and what he was birthing for focus more on international missionaries, he didn't even want to do his content with US pastors in the beginning. It
Yeah.
really was for international folks. It was really when Peter Wagner came along that you got the getting this into the American church.
Yeah.
And that's why what we talk about is the co-opting of McGavran. I mean, McGavran's ideals were urgency of evangelism, relational disciple making, the expansion of the church. His scorecard was not individual large, churches with big attendance. His
No.
scorecard was the collective of attendance. If you just pause on that, and I'm going to get to Drucker, but if you pause on that and say, if that was what we would call the founder of the modern church growth movement scorecard, we can't argue that there's not been a co-opting then, because
Exactly.
that is not the scorecard of the church today. The scorecard has evolved away from that, and that's what I call in the book the co-opting of McGavran. How did we get from what McGavran was championing to what we have today? The product, I believe, is a consumer-driven operating system, but how do we get there? And here's what's fascinating: it's not because a bunch of ornery people sat behind a curtain trying to do mischievous stuff. When you take every step along the way, it's well-intentioned, often evangelists who are just nutty about how do we reach lost people. And so here's the evolution, and I'll introduce Peter Drucker. You've got Robert Schuller, who people know his name. Schuller was a brilliant bringing marketing to the church, who came, even earlier than Drucker. Bill Hybels was impacted a lot by Schuller, but Schuller's deal was marketing. And when you think about marketing, the big issue with marketing is, okay, a customer orientation, who's the customer? So you've got this generation of evolving boomers, Rick Warren, Bill Hybels, Randy Pope, a bunch of what we'd call the founders of the megachurch movement, who are taking a customer orientation and really asking the question from a marketing perspective, who is our customer? How are we going to reach them? Enter Peter Drucker. Peter Drucker is the father of the modern management, born back around 1900. He basically was had a season of politics and journalism, and then when he came to the US, had the good fortune of being hired by General Motors way early on to look at their business model, and he wrote his really prominent first business book at that point. He eventually concluded that the nonprofit sector was going to be the solution to society and eventually tweaked that into, I think this large church, he called it the large church phenomena, is what could really be hopeful for the future of the US. What we need to understand is Drucker's context was customer orientation, customer orientation. Drucker ended up mentoring Rick Warren, mentoring Bill Hybels. Bob Buford, the founder of Leadership Network, mentored by Drucker. In fact, some of the negative pressure get called those three the Druckerites. You had Drucker the mentor, and then you had Hybels championing the seeker movement, Warren championing purpose-driven, and Buford championing business principles in the church. And at the core of all of those is this customer orientation. I keep a poster or a print in my office commissioned by Bob Buford of Drucker's three questions: who's the customer, what do they value, how will we deliver it? That commissioned art piece was in Warren's office, was in Hybels' office, was in hundreds of around the country. So the big impact of Drucker was mentoring the, so we'll say, the founding pastors of the megachurch era and disciple, I'm going to say discipling them in the customer orientation. And it's that customer orientation that eventually delivers us a consumer-driven operating system.
Yeah. As you're describing it, it feels like you've got these people who are Christians, who are Christian leaders, who have, as you said, a true desire to see people come to Christ. This is not nefarious. This is, I use the term, you've used the term, an unintended negative
Right.
consequence. And they go to Drucker and they see what feels like apps. It feels like, hey, here's new ways to kind of present this. And in fact, when they presented it to us, they would often talk about how our theology and our basis and our operating system stays the same, but we've got to be adaptable in our methods. But these business principles that started out as good new methods, good new apps, in fact, were far more of an operating system and far more of a culture shift than maybe we recognized at the time. Is that an accurate way of framing it?
I would actually, and again, this is my opinion now because there's the history of the facts, and then we've got to extract from it our, what do we believe? I would argue that the purpose-driven model, which was an app, has now become the foundation of the consumer-driven operating system. Not because Rick Warren intended it to be that way, because his model got co-opted. And let me tell you what I mean by that. The model is, if you think about the baseball diamond, get people converted at first base, get them growing, get them serving, send them off to get them to home plate. It is a disciple-making journey around his bases, which is somewhat in line with McGavern. In fact, he did his study at Fuller and was more of a McGavern person, Rick Warren, than probably a Schuller person. And when you look what really happened in his model, is I believe strongly what happened. First base of getting people to first base, which is get them converted, that became winning in the church. Not getting them around the bases, but getting them to first base. And if you say, well, how do you put strategy in place? What do you do to get the most number of people to first base as fast as you can? That explains how we now have the consumer-driven operating system. It's all about marketing and outreach tactics, all the institutional consumer things that get as many people to first base as quick as you can. I would even say the scorecard has become whoever gets the most people to first base wins.
No, that sounds very accurate. One of my frustrations with the way the purpose-driven model was adopted is the base of the purpose-driven model was not the base paths. The foundation of the purpose-driven model was the purposes of Christ for his church, the Great
Right.
Commandment and the Great Commission. I remember reading through, in fact, before I read Purpose-Driven Church, because I live in Orange County, I visited Saddleback and I learned from, I was sitting in a room with only 300 or 400 pastors really early on before Rick became a national name. And I got this folder that eventually became Purpose-Driven Church, and I'm filling in Rick's blanks. But the thing that struck me wasn't the base paths, because I saw that as a model and not as the foundation. The foundation was what I had already been taught in Bible college, which was the five purposes of God as seen through the Great Commandment and the Great Commission. And I learned it and went, oh yeah, that are the purposes. And Rick put that front and center and said, let's make sure everything we do matches these
Right.
five purposes. It's not base paths driven church, it's purpose driven church. But we love the app and we don't pay enough attention to the operating system. And Rick's operating system, or his intended operating system, let me put it that way, the purposes was the five purposes of the church as seen through the Great Commandment and the Great Commission. But we loved this base paths model so much, we made it our operating system. Is that, again, an accurate way of looking at it?
I think that is exactly accurate. I mean, we've got to give Rick credit. I mean, let me highlight a story for you. My home church, where I came out of the marketplace into ministry 30 years ago, was a purpose-driven church. Our lead pastor, Brett Andrews, the founding church of Exponential, he was probably at one of those early events you were at. 1993, Rick Warren went on tour to 13 cities around the country. Bob Buford funded him. And it was before there was ever a book. Many of the churches founded in that time period were founded on those principles, the purpose-driven principles. And just like I'll call it the co-opting of McGavran, you can argue there's been a co-opting of Rick's, whatever word you want to put on it, system, app, model, but all of these co-optings that have happened with good intentions for reaching lost people and doing things have delivered for us an operating system that is just not going to get us where we need to be in the future.
I fully agree. And we're trying to look for causes, and it's really easy for some people to jump on some of the founders of this as villains. And I refuse to villainize people who did great work for the kingdom of God and had great intention to bring people into the kingdom of God, and from whom I learned a lot of really good, positive things, but out of which there are some negative consequences that, quite frankly, you can't see through the windshield. You can only see in the rearview mirror. And we have to understand we're looking at this through the rearview mirror. So we have to
Right.
be careful to not ascribe motives to people that do not belong to them. But we have to also accurately identify them so that we can move looking through the windshield into the future in a better way.
Carl, that is exactly right. Robert Lewis is one of my mentors. Robert, longtime megachurch pastor, handed off the reins in the early 2000s. He did the foreword on the book, and he gave me the feedback of what you just said, that he lived through most of this. It was energetic. It was well-intentioned, up and to the right. And he said, it's not until looking back right now and reading the integrated story that he can see it with clarity what was going on and name what was going on. But it was well-intentioned along the way. I mean, I just want to highlight personally, I would not be sitting here talking to you right now if Bill Hybels hadn't done what he did. I grew up down the street from. I used to ride my mini bike where they built the church. The first time I really went to church in a substantive way, my mom took me kicking and screaming in high school to this new church in a movie theater. And what I remember about that experience is when we pulled out the parking lot and my mom said, "What'd you think about church?" And as a expert on church in high school, a guy who'd never been to church, my comment was, "I'm not sure what that was, but that wasn't church."
Which was one of Hybels's real goals, was to
Yep.
a church for people who don't like church.
And that's what I'm saying. We were in that customer orientation. We were the seeker avatar that he was trying to reach with the seeker movement. And guess what? I end up becoming a Christian. My brother becomes a Christian. My sister becomes a Christian. I mean, this is like this love-hate thing here. It's like, I don't want to just throw all that under the bus kind of thing. There's good that comes out of it, but we do need to name the fact that amongst the good, we've co-opted things in a way that it really has diluted from some of the original intentions of McGavern and Warren and others.
And now a short break to talk about something else. If you like the content you're hearing, here are two things you can do for us. First, forward this podcast to a friend. Second, consider becoming a financial supporter through Patreon, Venmo, or PayPal. Just go to carlvaders.com/support. For as little as $3 a month, you can help us put these resources into the hands of the ministries that need them the most. Our support link is in the show notes. Okay, so we've identified, and we've, I think, really very much agreed on some of the challenges here, some of the problems, again, unintended negative consequences. But what does that mean for us? Because we are no longer in that era. As you mentioned earlier, you talk to younger pastors especially, and they go, I've heard of that base pass thing, but what is that really? So we are really no longer in that era. And in fact, you define the eras that we've been through. So let me read them to you from your own book. Because you are in the same place that I know I am in at this point. When you just so everybody listening, when you get to the point where you're beginning to promote your own book, you're sick of your own book. And there are doors in your brain that have closed about what you actually put in your book. So this is why, because people hear me regularly interviewing authors, and I'm always quoting their own book back to them and asking for comment. And the reason is because they don't remember it. Once they hear it, then it sparks them, and then they can offer the explanation. So I know that's where you are, because I've been there many times myself. But you outline these discernible eras. So it starts with the McGavern missionary insights, which we've talked about, and then the seeker-sensitive movement, which is primarily Hybels, right?
Yep.
And then purpose-driven, which is from Rick Warren. And out of that, we get this megachurch explosion. So the megachurch explosion was what? We're talking 90s and O's,
Yep.
pretty much,
Well, really into the
late 80s.
90s, late 80s into the 90s.
Okay. And then out of that, where are we now? How would you define the era that we're in now?
I would say that we went through the growth part of the eras, which would have been the mega. We went into what I'd call the institutionalization era that we're already out of. And that's one of the most fascinating eras relative to the birth of the modern business sector. People don't realize that church leadership, we get fascinated with church leadership. The whole sector of church leadership, it wasn't even born till the early 90s.
No.
It wasn't a thing until the early 90s. And when you look what happened in the 90s, all of a sudden, you've got the explosion of books and resources and conferences. And before that, you didn't have any of that. In fact, I think one of the most pivotal shifts in this whole timeline is what I would call the birth of the church CEO, which prompted the birth of the church COO or executive pastor, where we're mimicking in the church the marketplace. And there's no way around it. When you're growing big things, the root of it is, when you get to where you've got thousands of people, you've shifted from a cause-based organization to an enterprise. And now you've got all the enterprise dynamics at play. It's sort of a bittersweet thing. It's like we want to grow big, and then there's all these enterprise dynamics that create tensions and sideways energy and take us off mission and do things. So you've got that going on in the 80s and 90s with the explosion of the mega piece of it. I believe we come into about 2005 and we're winding down the modern church growth era at that point. It's been institutionalized. And now we're looking extra. You've got all these apostolic entrepreneurial mega church leaders who begin looking outward. And I would call that the outwardly focused era. So you've literally got externally focused church. You've got the birth of church planting networks. People don't realize before 2000, denominations planted churches. There's no Acts 29, no city to city, no stadia, no new thing, no GlocalNet. All of those church planting networks that we see as the church planting organizations today, they're birthed in the 2000 to 2005 window. That's all as these entrepreneurial megaleaders are looking outside the walls of the church. So you get externally focused, you get church planting networks, you get multi-site, you get the missional attractional conversation, and you get the multi-ethnic conversation. And I would put all of those in the 2005 to 2015 window. And then we get to what feels like the forest burning down. I would call 2015 to 2025 the disruption era. And figuratively, you've got COVID sitting right in the middle of it. But from 2015 to 2025, the forest is burning down. I believe we've got the fracturing of evangelicalism. Personally, I don't see it coming back. I think it's fractured in a way that it doesn't come back. And so, if there's good news or hope in all that, we're in the disruption era, but usually what comes after the forest burns down is revival, new life, new birth. And I think that's where the optimism by some people comes in with what's happening with the next generation, and which we could talk about that too. But I think we're currently hopefully winding down the what I'd call the disruption era.
Okay, so we started talking about this consumer-driven operating system. How much of that is still in play? What should the new operating system be? And how are we doing with that transition? Because that's, as anybody who's had a massive, a full integer digit from an 8 point to a 9 point operating system change on any of their electronics know, it takes a little while to adapt. And if we're talking about a church operating system, we're talking decadal adaptive. So where are we in the in that right now, do you think?
I would use the words revolutionary versus evolutionary change in what you're talking about. I've tried to go from Apple to Android 3 times, and after a week I go back. It's revolutionary change for me to go from one operating system to a different one. I don't mind going from 11.1 to 11.2 to 11.3 or even 11 to 12 in the versions. That's evolutionary. Our challenge in your question of where's next is that this consumer-driven operating system is so deeply embedded in things right now. It gets inherited by the next generation of planters and people without even thinking. There's no stopping to think about it. We inherit it. The 70 years of modern church growth movement, you had 3 generations before it actually happened. You had the lost generation, you had the greatest generation, you had the silent generation. McGavran's 5 generations back. McGavran, Schuller, Drucker, all of those guys didn't build the modern what we have today. They set the stage for it. Along come the boomers, and the boomers build. Hybels, Warren, you can go make the list of all the builders that did what we're doing. And now what's happened, it's subtly happened, but it's significant. The handoff has happened to where the gatekeepers of the church in America right now are Gen X. And they have inherited and embraced that operating system. Now you've got increasingly millennials even taking over some of them, some of the prominent churches, and they are inheriting and taking over. The question we've got is how do you get revolutionary change when the gatekeepers have strongly embraced the consumer-driven operating system? And I don't personally think that it's a strategy we put in place or what. It is going to be a generational thing, I believe, that's going to get us to a different operating system. And it's going to be a generation that says enough with the institutional programmatic growth curves and enterprise models and stuff. Let's get back to relational disciple making. Let's get back to a growth engine that's the way Jesus did it with 12 disciples. Let's get back to a simple, reproducible thing that's not measured by how big it gets, but it's measured by generational ripple effect that comes out of it. And if I have any optimism, it isn't that I'm overly optimistic about Gen Z or Gen Alpha. I'm optimistic that it's a generational factor that gives us change. And we are in that generational shift where I'm hopeful that this relational disciple-making engine that can replace a consumer-driven one, we're going to see it take place in college settings and marketplace. I think we're going to see it taking place beyond the walls of the church and rethinking even what we're calling church is what, I'm not trying to be predictive here.
I mean, what you're describing to me, tell me if it's this is too severe. It almost sounds like everybody over 20 has to die in the desert first.
I'm glad they're your words and not mine. I mean, I've tried in this book to really take a grace-filled, hopeful, not be overly negative. I want to present the timeline, present the facts. I just don't think you can look, if the past is an indicator of the future, we have 70 years of evolution and co-opting, giving us this deeply, deeply embedded thing that we are now inheriting or, passing on. So what's it take to stop passing it on or to start using a different thing? I mean, I don't want to be, again, authoritative here. I don't see us evolving the consumer-driven operating system into the new thing that is hopeful for the future. I don't see us evolving it. So it means we need revolutionary change. It's not evolutionary. We need revolutionary change. And I don't know that that's going to come from the gatekeepers. Now, the gatekeepers can take the role of empowering, equipping, taking the posture of how can we help you, next generation?
Right.
And that's how I end the book. Look, what we've got to do is die to ourselves, those of us that are builders and gatekeepers, and we need to maybe keep our mouth shut a little bit more and empower a little bit more. I think the challenge is the guardrails on that. I mean, part of this current disruption era is a theological erosion. We can't underestimate this theological erosion that's happened because as we get the energy of the next generation, we can be very in danger of just the next new age movement if we're not careful. I mean, there's no guarantees about what's at the center of this new thing that happens with a new operating system.
Yeah. As with every spiritual revolution, there are also unintended negative consequences, just like we've seen, including those theological extremes that we need to set up guardrails against, which is, I used the extreme, Moses analogy of everybody over 20 dying in the desert. But the other part of that, of course, is that Moses did hand off to Joshua. If we, as the Moses, because you and I are in the Moses generation of this particular era of church leadership, to be able to hand off to a Joshua, we've been blessed in our congregation that I handed the pastorate of my church off to my church, the church I serve, off to my Gen X era youth pastor, who immediately has begun handing off to the millennials and to that next generation. He didn't wait like I waited to train the next generation. I didn't wait intentionally, but I was stuck in the middle of this consumer-driven operating system and I operated that way. He is further outside of that than I am. And now, those that he's training under him that we're now seeing raise up in our church are very much outside of that and have so little familiarity with the problems that you and I are talking about that it's actually really refreshing because they don't have to unlearn that stuff.
Right. What I've wrestled with a little bit, Carl, on this is from 1995 to about 2002 in my research, Leadership Network in the early 90s, one of the top issues that they were having identified to them was from boomer megachurch pastors, how are we going to find the next generation of leaders? How are we going to mobilize the next generation of leaders? So Leadership Network convened what they called their Young Leaders Network. They went and found Gen X leaders who were in their 20s that were going to be planting the churches of the future. And they brought those leaders together for about 5 years. It would have been fascinating to be in this group. In this group is Mark Driscoll before he plants his church, Chris See, Dan Kimball. The list was amazing of people in this group. And when I interviewed as many of those people in the group as I could, these are at the time, they're young Gen X leaders who want to take the world and they're going to mobilize to plant churches. What brought them together, believe it or not, was Leslie Newbegin's missional teaching. They came together and said, how do we plant missional churches to meet the needs of postmoderns and reach postmoderns? And when you hear that part of the story, put us where we are right now. There's young people, energetic. How do we reach the next generation? How do we not be constrained by the current consumer-driven system? How do we get to the next thing? And the first question you got to ask is, there's a group of change makers in 1995 to 2000 who are the kinds of people that would change things. And now you look 25 years later and say, well, why hasn't it changed? And then you look at what happened from 2000 to 2005 with the missional conversation. Another one of my learnings in this, I went back and read about 20 of the missional books from 2000 to 2005 window, Alan Hirsch and many others. we need to go back to a lot of those books. A lot of them were really solid in what they were saying. But the strength of this operating system and what command it had in the 2000 to 2005 window was too much for the missional conversation.
Yeah.
It also got squeezed out. And so what I'm trying to say is I don't want to be too negative, or there's no, the optimism's going to come in what does it look like to overcome that which is so deeply embedded? What's it look like to do something that the previous two generations haven't been able to do? What role do those of us play in the previous generations to enable and equip the next generations to do what needs to happen? And that's where the burden needs to come from as we're thinking about this.
Yeah, and we won't have a chance of assisting in that transition if we don't start understanding the operating system that we've been living under. If we just continue to offer app-based solutions under the same operating system, we have no chance of getting there. There's so much in this and so much more we could talk to you about. So my plan is when you do write that book you intended to write to begin with that you got diverted from, we'll have you back so that we can have the next step of this conversation. But what I want to do is in the bonus material, I want to talk just through a handful of the 12 dilemmas of our prevailing operating system, which is the foundation that you started with for this, just to give some people some ideas of that. So if anybody wants to get any of this or any of the previous podcast bonus material, you can do that one of two ways. If you become a financial partner of this ministry, go to carlvaders.com/support. And if you become a partner, you'll get some bonus material, including the free weekly newsletter that gives you access to all of our bonus podcasts. If all you want is the bonus podcast and none of the other material, you can become a free newsletter subscriber by going to carlvaders.com/subscribe. Either way, you get this bonus material from Todd and all of the previous bonus materials from all of our previous podcast guests. So in order to do that, what we're going to do again is we're going to take about 10 minutes or so. Obviously, we're not going to get through 12 important points in 10 minutes, but we're going to give you a quick idea of what that's about, and you can anticipate both what's in the book currently and what's in the next book coming up. But before I let you go, as everybody has to, you've got to do the lightning round. Are you ready for the lightning round, Todd?
I hope so, Carl.
There's always this sense of anticipation and sometimes dread from my guests, but it's seldom as bad as it feels. All right. Question number one, what are the biggest changes you've seen in your field of ministry in the last few years, and how have you adapted to them?
I would say, I mean, my ministry the last 20 years has really been in the church planting space. And so in that area, there has been this shift from a denominational centric to a network centric. Those networks have now, many of them, grown to also large institution. And now we're seeing a more decentralized geographic base, things like Carolina Movement and Multiply Indiana and the Houston Church Planting Network. We're seeing a lot more of the traction and action happening in a decentralized way. And there's just so many emerging and evolving networks that are happening. So on a positive side, it's becoming much more decentralized. And that's why we got to get that revolutionary change, because we're going to just keep reproducing an old model of things in an accelerated way.
Yeah, some of the pot we mentioned earlier about how church planting, for instance, and so much of church life happened through denominational doors. It's not the denominations are gone, they're still around,
Right.
but we are definitely in a post-denominational era where the primary connectivity between churches and pastors is typically not along denominational lines. And there are some negatives to that because sometimes that allows for theological drift. And there are some positives to that because now we get to share resources that are not from such a narrow worldview as we have only within our denominations. And I think that's going to accelerate as well. So, yeah. So, question number two then becomes, what free resources like an app or a website have helped you lately that you would recommend for small church ministry?
Yeah, I take significant advantage as a nonprofit running one myself of TechSoup.org. If people haven't heard of it, it's a resource where you get some free, some significantly discounted resources there. My entire web stuff through Amazon AWS, I get like $1,000 a year of credits for less than $100 with TechSoup, and the membership there is free. So that's the one.
TechSoup.org, as always, it'll be in the show notes. Number three, what's the best piece of ministry advice you've ever received?
Well, I'm going to give you two if it's okay. One's
Sure.
general, one's specific. The specific, I'm very entrepreneurial. I like to start new things. So Bob Buford looked at me at one point and said, "Let me just tell you my number one piece of advice for you. You should never start something without an exit plan from what you're starting." So that idea of not, when you're dreaming up the new thing you're starting, how do I get myself out of it? How do I start it, but have an extraction plan that I'm not going to forever be captive in it? The second one was my calling into ministry to begin with. I had a wise person tell me when I was wrestling with calling, and all of us have that challenge, small church, big church, of is this really worth it? Should I quit? Should I go do something else? Should I move on? And before I ever got into ministry, I had someone tell me, look, the day is going to come when you're really going to struggle with, did I do the right thing? Should I quit? Should I whatever? And they said, you've really got to memorialize your calling. It's all, I lived in Washington, D.C. at the time. And they said, it's like one of these monuments downtown. You better get your calling nailed down in a way that it's going to sustain past the troubles and the difficulties. And so I just want to encourage and remind all these pastors that are listening that you're in this because of a calling God gave you. And you ought to every day remind yourself that, yes, I'm called. And yes, it's hard, but when you're called, God will provide.
Yeah, something strong enough to keep you through the troubles. That's huge, hugely important. Number four, what's the funniest or weirdest thing you've ever seen in church?
Okay. So remember, I was at a church very good with the consumer model. So we were very good at doing a lot of outreach things. So I want you to picture our church offices. We were very lean. We were in an old farmhouse that shared a driveway and a parking lot with a restaurant next door. And old man Payne was the man who ran the restaurant, and he did not like us parking in any of his spots or doing anything. And one evening, about 6 o'clock, after we thought the restaurant was closed, we were shooting a creative video for Sunday morning, which was Michael, it was a spoof off of Michael Jackson's Thriller video. And so we had 12 staff people dressed up as Goonies and, looking like dead people. And we had a couple of them in the big garbage can dumpster and a couple of them underground to come up out of the flower bed. And if you can imagine, we're right in the middle of this video shoot with 12 staff people in the back parking lot with all this stuff happening. And old man Payne comes running around in his Cadillac, jumps out of his car before he knows what's going on. And what in the world are all you people doing? And 12 Goonies come out into the parking lot surrounding his car. And so, needless to say, the police being called and other things was one of the funnier things.
Wow. Well, I mean, with the name Old Man Payne, which I assume you gave him rather than that was what
That's
his,
right.
although
That's
what
right.
was his actual last name, Payne?
Well, it was Payne's restaurant. We never knew
Oh,
his
okay.
name,
There
so
you
we just
go.
called him Old Man Payne as Payne's restaurant.
Yeah. I mean, you label a guy with that, he's not going to be able to get out of it either way. But yeah, that's going to get you noticed. That's for sure. Again, the book is How Did We Get Here? With two potential subtitles, Looking Back to Look Forward, or Examining 70 Years of the Church Growth Movement. Todd, thank you so much for your time with that today. We are now going to go into just a few minutes of that bonus material to give people some kind of an idea of some of what are you call the dilemmas of the prevailing operating system that we've got. But there's so much to chew on, so much to think about with this, and with the next book, which you intended to this one to be about originally, we'll have you back again so we can continue this conversation. But if anybody wants to reach out to you for anything, what's the best way for people to reach out to you and get in contact with you on social media, online, or what?
Yeah, my web page is multipliers.org, and you can get me at todd@multipliers.org. So through the website is the best way to do it.
All right. Thanks for your time today, Todd. I appreciate it very much.
Great to be with you, Carl. Thank you for having me.
As one of the primary drivers of the last 30 plus years of the church growth movement, I really appreciate that Todd has taken the time to look at that system with such clear but sympathetic eyes. And it's the combination of clarity and sympathy that I want to address as we conclude this episode. We live in a culture, both in and outside the church, where it's so easy to villainize people for what are often unintended errors. As we mentioned several times in the conversation, neither Todd nor I have found any villains in the mainstream of the church growth movement. The ideas that were raised by Donald McGavran were and are solid. The intentions of the main carriers of his ideas, from C. Peter Wagner to Robert Schuller, Bob Buford, Bill Hybels, Rick Warren, and so on, these were people with a passion to reach people for Jesus. For some, their success twisted their results. For others, the institutions they built had a gravitational pull that, as Todd mentioned, sometimes put the theological emphasis on the back burner as their methods were put front and center. The answer moving forward is humility. Nothing we do will ever be perfect. It will always have unintended negative consequences. But when we determine to always be learners and seekers of God's truth, staying in a posture of humility, we can mitigate them. Arrogance will cause methodological blindness, but humility will give us the chance to see and correct our mistakes so the unintended consequences don't get embedded in the institutions for future generations to have to deal with. This episode was produced by Veronica Beaver. It was edited by Phil Vaders. Original theme music was written and performed by Jack Wilkins of jackwilkinsmusic.com. The graphic design is by Solomon Joy. And me, I'm Carl Vaders, and I hope to talk with you again in the church lobby.